Hello, this is Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you two articles from the New York Times today, a GOP bill restricting persons with disabilities voting rights, a man kept seeing sparkly spots before his eyes, from the readingleague.org, decodable text sources for your children. Bookriot.com has a list of Goodreads top 48. A little funny, why go to church? The AFB has a virtual event coming up, and I will read some of the June issue of the Blind Post if I still have time. So let's get started. From the NewYorkTimes.com, GOP bills rattle disabled voters. We don't have a voice anymore. Legislation across the country would restrict voting methods and accommodations that people with disabilities are disproportionately likely to rely on. Published June 14th, the experience was so demeaning that Susie Angel did not vote again for two decades. It was 1991, she recalled, and she was a 21-year-old learning to live independently with cerebral palsy, which she has had since birth. She waited in line at her polling place in Austin, Texas, for hours. Then she waited for a poll worker who could help her complete her ballot. Finally, the worker refused to take her aside, making her name her preferred candidates in full view and earshot of other voters. Ms. Angel, who has limited use of her limbs and a speech impairment and uses a foot-operated power wheelchair, left understanding that unlike other Americans, she couldn't vote privately. It was only when she began working for the Coalition of Texans with Disabilities in 2010 and learned about the adaptive equipment available to her that she was able to vote independently, an experience that brought her to tears. Now Ms. Angel is watching the Texas legislature pursue sweeping voting restrictions, afraid that she and others with disabilities might again be deterred from voting. They're really making it so we don't have a voice anymore, she said, and without that, we can't get the things that we need to survive. The Texas legislation, which Democrats blocked but Republicans plan to revive in a special session, is one of a series of Republican voting bills that would disproportionately affect people with disabilities. The Wisconsin Senate approved three last week with more to come, although unlike in Texas, the governor there is a Democrat and is expected to veto them. Georgia and Florida have enacted similar measures. For years, advocates have worked to mobilize Americans with disabilities, more than 38 million of whom are eligible to vote, according to researchers at Rutgers University, into a voting bloc powerful enough to demand that politicians address their needs. Now, after an election in which mail-in voting helped them turn out in large numbers, the restrictive proposals are simultaneously threatening their rights and testing their nascent political influence. It's only been the last few years that there have been studies done showing that if candidates would appeal to issues that the disability community cares about, there is such a thing as the disability vote, said Bob Kafka, an organizer with Rev Up Texas, which aims to increase turnout among disabled Texans. That's why you're seeing it playing out in Georgia and here and other places where the disability community is part of the larger fight against voter suppression. The fight also underscores the degree to which disability rights, once championed both by Democrats like former Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa and Republicans like former Senator Bob Dole of Kansas, have become one more partisan football, even though there are millions of disabled voters in both parties. The most recent version of the Texas bill would ban drive-through voting, further limit absentee voting in a state that already has strict eligibility rules, and let poll watchers record video of voters as purported evidence of wrongdoing. Disability rights advocates worry that partisan poll watchers will misinterpret legal accommodations, like a worker helping a disabled voter complete a ballot, or a blind voter using a screen reader, as fraud. Bills in Wisconsin would restrict who could return voters' ballots on their behalf, weaken accommodations for indefinitely confined voters who cannot vote in person because of age, illness, or disability, limit ballot drop boxes and restrict their locations, effectively reducing their accessibility to voters with disabilities, and forbid municipal clerks to correct small mistakes on ballot envelopes. Breaking many of the new rules would be a felony, a characteristic of bills in several states that advocates said could discourage people from helping friends or neighbors. It's made organizations like ours start questioning, should we do that? Because a simple mistake on our end could put them in jeopardy and our organization in jeopardy, said Chase Bearden, Deputy Executive Director of the Coalition of Texans with Disabilities. That's a pretty chilling effect. A spokesman for State Senator Brian Hughes, the lead author of the Texas legislation, did not respond to a request for comment. State Senator Dewey Strobel of Wisconsin, who was sponsoring some of the bills there, called them a reasonable balancing of priorities. I want to ensure that self-certifying, as indefinitely confined, is not a de facto workaround to election integrity measures already on the books, Mr. Strobel said, regarding the limits on who could return ballots. Any current practice for an individual who is not engaging in orchestrated mass ballot harvesting should be allowed by our bill. Also, a voter can simply return the ballot by mail. At the same time, some disabled voters have found it difficult even to express their opposition. In Georgia and Florida, some who wanted to speak at public hearings couldn't because they were at high risk from the coronavirus. Olivia Babas, a senior public policy analyst at Disability Rights Florida, said one voter had attended a hearing but because of a speech impediment struggled to make her points in the allotted 60 seconds. Both states' bills passed but face legal challenges. Last month, three disability rights groups joined a lawsuit arguing that Georgia's law violated the Americans with Disabilities Act, in addition to, as the original plaintiffs alleged, the Constitution and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Ms. Babas expressed particular concern about Florida's new rules on absentee ballot applications. People must apply every election cycle instead of every two, a significant obstacle because many counties' websites are inaccessible to people with disabilities. And signature matching. Partisan poll watchers can expect ballot envelopes including signatures. People with disabilities are disproportionately affected by signature matching as it stands anywhere, Ms. Babas said, noting that visual impairments, brain injuries, and other disabilities can prevent people from signing their name consistently. Now we're throwing more people in to potentially challenge signatures who don't necessarily have expertise in handwriting analysis. The Georgia law replaced signature matching with a requirement that absentee voters submit the number from a state ID, which poses its own obstacles for disabled voters who don't have a driver's license and cannot easily get to an office to obtain an ID. Lobbying by disability groups has had some impact. In Wisconsin last month, legislators modified some proposals that had alarmed disabled voters. For instance, in the initial version of one bill, voters who needed help returning their ballot would have to get it from an immediate family member or legal guardian if they had one in Wisconsin. If a disabled voter in Milwaukee had a sibling in Ashland, 350 miles away, it would have been illegal to rely on a neighbor. The bill was amended to allow people to designate someone other than a family member, regardless of whether they had family in state, but no individual could return more than two non-relatives' ballots. Another measure in Wisconsin would have required anyone under 65 who applied for indefinitely confined status to provide a doctor's note. Republicans said this would prevent people from claiming the status fraudulently and pointed to the Milwaukee and Dane County clerk statements early last year that because of a statewide stay-at-home order, any voter could claim it. After the Wisconsin Supreme Court ordered them to stop, the clerks rescinded that advice. The court later affirmed that individual voters could decide whether they qualified. According to the Wisconsin Elections Commission, 80% of people who claimed the status last year had ID on file. Disabled voters expressed concern that beyond the difficulty of finding transportation to appointments, the measure would require doctors to attest to matters outside of their scope of practice, and that insurers might refuse to cover office visits to obtain such notes, deeming them medically unnecessary. Denise Jess, the executive director of the Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired, said she worried that her doctor wouldn't even be willing to make an assessment about her ability to travel to a polling place. The battle over voting rights. After the former President Donald J. Trump returned in recent months to making false claims that the 2020 election was stolen from him, Republican lawmakers in many states have marched ahead to pass laws making it harder to vote and change how elections are run, frustrating Democrats and even some election officials in their own party. A key topic, the rules and procedures of elections have become central issues in American politics. As of May 14th, lawmakers had passed 22 new laws in 14 states to make the process of voting more difficult, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, a research institute. The basic measures. The restrictions vary by state, but can include limiting the use of ballot drop boxes, adding identification requirements for voters requesting absentee ballots, and doing away with local laws that allow automatic registration for absentee voting. More extreme measures. Some measures go beyond altering how one votes, including tweaking electoral college and judicial election rules, clamping down on citizen-led ballot initiatives, and outlawing private donations that provide resources for administering elections. Pushback. This Republican effort has led Democrats in Congress to find a way to pass federal voting laws. A sweeping voting rights bill passed the House in March, but faces difficult obstacles in the Senate, including from Joe Manchin III, Democrat of West Virginia. Republicans have remained united against the proposal, and even if the bill became law, it would most likely face steep legal challenges. Florida. Measures here include limiting the use of drop boxes, adding more identification requirements for absentee ballots, requiring voters to request an absentee ballot for each election, limiting who could collect and drop off ballots, and further empowering partisan observers during the ballot counting process. Texas. Texas Democrats successfully blocked the state's expansive voting bill known as SB 7 in a late-night walkout and are starting a major statewide registration program focused on racially diverse communities. But Republicans in the state have pledged to return in a special session and pass a similar voting bill. SB 7 included new restrictions on absentee voting, granted broad new autonomy and authority to partisan poll watchers, escalated punishments for mistakes or offenses by election officials, and banned both drive-through voting and 24-hour voting. Other states. Arizona's Republican-controlled legislature passed a bill that would limit the distribution of mail ballots. The bill, which includes removing voters from the state's permanent early voting list if they do not cast a ballot at least once every 2 years, may be only the first in a series of voting restrictions to be enacted there. Georgia Republicans in March enacted far-reaching new voting laws that limit ballot drop boxes and make the distribution of water within certain boundaries of a polling station a misdemeanor. And Iowa has imposed new limits, including reducing the period for early voting and in-person voting hours on Election Day. Mr. Strobel said Wednesday that the Wisconsin bill containing the requirement would not receive a vote. A similar doctor's note requirement was removed from the Texas legislation after lobbying from disability rights advocates. But disabled voters in Wisconsin said they remained deeply worried by what the Senate had passed. Ms. Jess, who is blind, prefers to vote in person because polling places have accessible equipment for visually impaired voters to complete ballots independently. But at some point, she said, it might become impossible for her to travel safely, in which case she would have to find someone she trusts to mark her absentee ballot and then find a legally acceptable person to return it. She and other voters also expressed concern about a bill that would tighten identification requirements for indefinitely confined voters who have difficulties traveling. When Wisconsin legislators enacted a photo ID requirement years ago, they maintained this exception for indefinitely confined voters, said Barbara Beckert, Disability Rights Wisconsin's Milwaukee office director. There was a reason for that, and that reason hasn't changed. Advocates like Ms. Beckert and Kai Kleist, K-L-I-E-I-S-T, executive director of the Center for Independent Living for Western Wisconsin, said they had worked with State Senator Kathy Bernier, a Republican who leads the Senate Elections Committee, and broke with her party this month when she voted against advancing three bills because of their effects on people with disabilities. Ms. Bernier's opposition denied the bills a majority on the Elections Committee, but the full Senate approved them anyway. Only one other Republican, Rob Coles, cast a no vote. They now go to the State Assembly, which is also Republican-controlled. And while some Republicans there have been receptive to acknowledging what the barriers are, Mr. Kleist said, still they're pushing forward a full steam ahead. Texas Republicans are also undeterred. They have vowed to pass their bill over all opposition, and Governor Greg Abbott, who is himself disabled, is expected to sign it. It is discouraging, said Kenneth Seaman, an activist with the Coalition of Texans with Disabilities and the American Council of the Blind of Texas. But I know advocacy will continue for the rest of our lives. Also from NYTimes.com, he kept seeing sparkly dots on the edge of his vision. What was it? A worrying smudge on a photo of his retina became an important clue. Posted June 16th. The golden retriever bounded down the stairs with his 66-year-old owner right behind him. This afternoon romp in the backyard was a high point of the COVID-19 homebound days for both of them. This time, though, the man abruptly stopped halfway down. He hadn't hit his head, but he was seeing stars in the upper right corner of his vision. When he closed his right eye, the stars remained. He closed his left eye. They disappeared. He wondered what that was. But not for long. His 5-year-old dog was still acting like a puppy and demanded his attention. And when he looked for the stars a few minutes later, they were gone. They didn't stay gone, though. At first, it seemed as if the stars appeared only when he was running up or down stairs, but as soon they appeared randomly at just about any time of the day or night. Nothing hurt, he would just suddenly see this cluster of sparkly dots. After 2 weeks or so, when it seemed clear this wasn't going to go away on its own, he called his eye doctor. The doctor did all her usual tests. The sparkly aspect of the image was suggestive of a retinal problem, she told him, but his retina, and indeed the rest of his eye, looked completely normal. Let's wait and see what happens, she suggested. Either it was nothing and it would just go away, or it would progress and there would be something for her to see. The man found it reassuring, if not completely satisfying. He tried to ignore the little dazzles while he waited for them to either go away or get worse. Days passed, and they didn't go away. If anything, the episodes became more frequent. And then they got worse. One afternoon, the sparkles were followed by a burst of bright white light, like a flash from an old-fashioned camera, smack in the middle of his visual field. It took a minute or so for his vision to come back. After that, the world started to seem a little grayer. That really scared him. A yellow-gray smear. He went back to his ophthalmologist with each change. On the third visit, she saw something and immediately arranged for him to see Dr. Marianelli Rodriguez, an ophthalmologist who specializes in diseases of the retina in Worcester, Mass., 20 minutes away. The next day at this new office, the patient went through the now familiar tests, plus a couple of new ones. Afterward, as the patient sat waiting in the tiny exam room, Rodriguez looked over the pictures of the inside of his left eye. She identified three problems. First, the optic nerve was swollen. Normally, the spot where the nerve enters the eye from the brain is a crisply defined, bright circle in the dark red background of the retina. In this man's eye, the edge seemed blurry, and the flat screen of the retina seemed to bulge forward around the fuzzy circle. Second, in the macula, where most of the seeing takes place, the normally darker red of the vision center was obscured by a smear of yellow-gray material. That was why he wasn't seeing well. Finally, in the normally clear fluid that filled the eye itself, a thick gel called the vitreous humor, Rodriguez could see tiny white specks. These, she suspected, were white blood cells. The presence of those cells suggested two possible disease processes. This could be a type of cancer known as lymphoma. That was rare but had to be considered. The other possibility was that this was some type of infection and those white cells were there to fight off the bug. The inside of the eye is an extremely well-protected part of the body. Still, some infections that travel through the bloodstream could get there. Only a few of these agents would cause the kind of problems she saw. Tuberculosis could certainly do this, and syphilis could do just about anything. A third possibility was a bacteria called Bartonella henslii, which usually causes a systemic infection called cat scratch fever. Asking an awkward question. Now that she knew what was going on in the eye, it was time to talk to the patient. He was a cheerful man with a ruddy round face and an easy smile. Other than this eye problem, he told her, he felt great. He wasn't tired, hadn't lost any weight, had no cough, didn't know anyone with TB, had a dog but no cats. The doctor paused. Have you ever had any sexually transmitted diseases? It was an awkward question, and sometimes people were offended when she asked it. Not this man. Absolutely, he told her without hesitation. 13 years earlier, he was diagnosed with syphilis and HIV. He'd been treated for 2 weeks for the syphilis and was still being treated for HIV. The virus was undetectable in his blood, he told her, and had been since the year after his diagnosis. He hadn't always practiced safe sex before his diagnosis, but he had been very careful since then, and he'd been tested for syphilis and other STDs regularly since getting this diagnosis. His last test was a couple of years ago and was negative. Rodriguez had trained as an ophthalmologist at Harvard Medical School, and her mentor, Dr. Dean Elliott, had a particular interest in ocular syphilis. She called him while the patient was still in her office. Elliott arranged to see him later that day. The smear across his macula was the injury and inflammation caused by the infection. But beneath that, Elliott could see another worrisome finding. Under the very center of the macula was a small cluster of abnormal blood vessels. If that process wasn't reversed, that part of his vision could be permanently lost. So in addition to being treated for his infection, the patient would also need treatment to get rid of these destructive blood vessels. The patient contacted his infectious disease specialist, Dr. Raul Devaro, who promptly tested him for syphilis, and the test was positive. The resurgence of an age-old enemy. The patient was stunned. Because the lesions caused by syphilis are usually painless, patients who are infected often are unaware that they have the disease. He worried about how his partner would feel hearing this. They'd been together almost 2 years and were always very careful. Days later, his partner reported the news from his own tests, negative. The patient was so relieved he almost cried. Now he just had to take care of himself. Although syphilis has been recognized since the 15th century, when it was first imported to Europe from the New World and has had an effective treatment since World War II, a new epidemic of cases has erupted in the 21st century. In one study, the number of reported cases nearly doubled in men and more than doubled in women from 2014 to 2018. It is increasingly common in those with HIV. The disease is and always has been protean in its manifestations. It is contracted through direct contact with a syphilitic lesion and then spreads through the body wherever it can take root. The causative agent, Treponema pallidum, a corkscrew-shaped bacterium, can invade the nervous system, including the brain, the eyes, or the ears at any point once it hits the bloodstream. The many manifestations of the disease, as well as the usually painless lesions of the infection, make this a difficult diagnosis. Indeed, Sir William Osler, the so-called father of modern medicine, said at the beginning of the last century that the doctor who really knew syphilis truly understood all of medicine. For the patient, this past fall and winter were consumed not by COVID-19, but by the treatment of his illness and the damage it had done. He had a total of 4 weeks of intravenous antibiotics and monthly injections of a medicine to kill off the obstructing new blood vessels in his eye. The patient felt squeamish when Elliott said he would have to get these injections directly into his eye, but Elliott told him that they weren't nearly as bad as they sounded, and that was true. Besides, he would do anything to get his vision back. By the time he started treatment, his vision was 2800 in his left eye. He is almost done with the eye injections, and his vision has improved to 2040. He hopes it will continue to get better, although he suspects his vision will never be quite as sharp as it once was. And he has been reminded, not that he ever thought he would need to be, how much care is required to truly stay safe. Lisa Sanders, MD, is a contributing writer for the magazine. Her latest book is Diagnosis, Solving the Most Baffling Medical Mysteries. If you have a solved case to share with Dr. Sanders, write her at lisa.sandersmd@gmail.com. The next webinar up on afb.org/100, The Centennial Conversation, Inclusion, Intersectionality, and the Future of Work. When? June 24th, 2021 at 2 p.m. Eastern. Cost? Free. Where? Live virtual event. Please register online at the hot link. Join us for a robust discussion with leaders who are blind or have low vision about what the future of work will look like. How can we strengthen the workplace inclusion and reduce inequalities of race, disability, and gender? How do we ensure that new workplace technologies are accessible and inclusive? And how can we share our understanding of a changing occupational landscape to inform, prepare, and train workers who are blind or have low vision? Moderator Katie Kelly, SVP, Talent Development Solutions Director for LHH. Panelists, Jenison Asuncion, Head of Accessibility Engineering Evangelism at LinkedIn, Carrie Gray, DEI Educator and Consultant on Race and Disability, Sarah Mankara, Founder and CEO of Sarah Mankara, LLC, Founder and Board Member of Empowerment Through Integration. Sachin Pavratan, Executive Director at United States Access Board. Register today at the hot link. AFB is committed to creating inclusive events. Captions, ASL, audio description, and transcripts will be available for all hashtag AFB100 events. We are grateful to our Centennial sponsors who have partnered with us in celebration and in affirmation of our shared commitment to make our world a more equitable one. Contact communications at afb.org for questions. You can register at the hot link. I'm just going to give you the link for thereadingleague.org for decodable text sources updated in May 2020. There are lists under each age range, best for young readers, best for older readers, for all ages, teens and adults. I'm running out of time and I can't read them all to you. From bookriot.com, Goodreads announces its top 48 hit books of the year so far, posted by Donica Ellis on June 16th. Goodreads has released its list of the most popular books of the year so far. There's a hot link for that. They do this by taking the books published in the first 6 months of 2021 that have been added to the most users want to read shelves, then eliminating any that fall below a 3.5-star average rating. There are 48 books on the list, split evenly between fiction and nonfiction. The Goodreads Choice Awards have become notorious for their lack of diversity, but this list is a nice surprise. Around half of the books featured are by authors of color, and there are a handful of queer books included as well, including Detransition Baby by Tori Peters. The list is not numbered, and it's unclear whether the order they're listed in is their ranking or not. Some of the titles were surefire hits, and I will stop reading theirs, and you can go to the website for the rest. From the June issue of The Blind Post by Lori Motis, the Burkeville Lodge for the Blind in Burkeville, Virginia is now open. We are a 501c3 organization and get no government help. We are a low-cost retreat for blind, visually impaired, and their friends and families. We have in-ground swimming pool and fishing and boating pond. For reservations, call 434-767-4080, or for more information, call Richard at 757-468-0277, or email thereb1948@gmail.com. Come and have fun. Several pianos and books to read and conversation. Spoken Word Ministries offers a Christian resource library to blind and visually impaired people. The library contains both books, Bible commentaries, and teachings. To apply, visit https://brailleaudio.org/ and complete the registration form. We also ask you to complete our brief survey at https://brailleaudio.org/survey. Thanks and blessing. Site Exchange is a place where blind members may give and receive items completely free, except for shipping costs if they are not blind-related. You may subscribe at Site Exchange plus subscribe at groups.io. Don't forget to listen to sermons on the phone, 773-572-6206, updated every 2 weeks. 9 options to choose from. Season 2 of the Adventure Mind podcast resumed on Tuesday, February 16. Search for Adventure Mind in your podcast app of choice or visit www.adventuremind.net for more information. Well, I ran out of time for today's episode of Vision News. Be sure to listen next week. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Doris Hyde reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.